I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. You've probably seen the video a customer tweeted of two black men, Rashawn Nelson and Dante Robinson, being led out of a Center City, Philadelphia Starbucks in handcuffs. This was back in mid-April. They were there to meet a friend. The manager had called the police saying the two refused to make a purchase and refused to leave. The pair were held for several hours and released without charges. There have been protests at that 18th and Spruce store and at police headquarters in Philadelphia and general outrage across the country. The police commissioner initially defended the actions of his officers and later admitted he made the situation worse. The Starbucks CEO has apologized. The Starbucks executive chairman said he was ashamed and embarrassed. Nelson and Robinson have met with city and Starbucks officials and said they wanted to turn a negative into a positive. All of this has led to all 8,000 Starbucks stores closing this afternoon so its employees can get training in how to understand and address racial bias. Our topic for today's Radio Times. We have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Kevin Woodson is Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. Kevin Woodson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Sitting next to Kevin is Stacey Sinclair. She's a professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University, where she studies prejudice and bias. Stacey Sinclair, nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests is Mark Kelly Tyler, pastor of Mother Bethel AME Church in Philadelphia. He's also co-chair of the Clergy Caucus of Power. Power stands for Philadelphians Organized to Witness, Empower, and Rebuild. And they led several protests at Starbucks. Mark Kelly Tyler, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me back.
You know, I was thinking about the controversy about NFL players being fined if they didn't take a knee during the anthem and comparing that to this incident at Starbucks. None of us are NFL players. All of us have gone to Starbucks or a coffee shop to meet someone. Let me start with you, Mark Kelly Tyler. What makes this moment, even this incident, so important?
Well, you know, there are certain defining moments in every movement, and whether people want to acknowledge it or not, we've been in a movement for the last several years. You know, started with Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, and really was solidified with the killing of Mike Brown in Ferguson. And for the longest, people said, you know, well, if Trayvon had only dressed appropriately. You know, there's the whole black respectability conversation that was surrounding it. If Mike Brown had only, you know, had a shirt and tie on. So there's this image that somehow these moments were only happening to young people who were just doing things that, you know, if they just, you know, kind of adopted the American dream. But here are two young black men, you know, one is in a fraternity. They're in Starbucks. I mean, what's more non-threatening as a black person than being in Starbucks? Right. And so if it can happen, I mean, I think it struck kind of middle class black America in a way that who hasn't gone in Starbucks? So I think that's what gives rise to the moment.
Well, and I don't want to speak for white people here, but to Stacey Sinclair, I mean, again, underscoring what Mark just said, who hasn't been at Starbucks, who hasn't snuck into the bathroom, who hasn't met a friend at Starbucks? Is it almost the mundanity of this incident that makes it so important?
I think so, definitely. So it illustrates the day-to-day drip, drip, drip of the bias that African-Americans experience every day in the United States.
And how about for you, Kevin? How do you see this?
Yeah, I would have to agree with all that's been said. I think that what's really interesting here is you see a fairly mundane sort of everyday discrimination that really escalates in a way that we're not accustomed to seeing. And so it really captures the full spectrum of what's going on in a way that's usually not apparent. So being a black male in a certain type of white space, white setting, there's often this sort of faint unease. There are concerns about standing out. There are concerns about being singled out for mistreatment. But rarely do we expect something as mundane as sitting in a Starbucks to just culminate in our arrest. And obviously there were a number of steps that happened in between. But I think that being able to capture all this on video and have witnesses there makes it a very powerful learning experience.
Mark, you and others have protested at that Starbucks. What did you want to accomplish?
First of all, we wanted to make sure that the moment was brought to light and really have attention. And there were a number of groups in addition to Power. I think there must have been five or six different demonstrations over the course of the weekend But power also brought a set of demands, and we had two sets. One was for Starbucks itself, the corporation, but the other was for the city, because, you know, you can't let the city of Philadelphia get off the hook. Many of the things we've been arguing about the police department in this city for the last 3 years, especially since the Department of Justice slammed them with their use of force, use of deadly force, were all recommendations in everything that happened in the incident. Lack of body cameras, you know, lack of skill with de-escalation techniques, not having proper training with implicit bias. Those are, I mean, we have literally been bringing those up for the last 3 years, and it all just popped up right in that moment. And so we wanted to see some reform in both of those places, and we're just as intent on holding the city accountable as with Starbucks.
Do you think the Commissioner Ross, when he admitted that he made this situation worse, does that give you confidence that, this can lead to something better?
Sure. So we've met with Commissioner Ross and the mayor. We had a big round table. Sad to say, that was like after we met with Starbucks CEO like four or five times. It was easier.
They were more amenable?
It was much easier meeting with them. They came to us. It took almost a month from the incident before we were able to sit down with our mayor. And the commissioner has been open, but I just think that speaks volumes to just, you know, why is there resistance from the people that we pay, that we elect to take care of us? It seems to me they would want to have the same kind of attitude that Starbucks has. And we just haven't seen that yet. The meeting was somewhat fruitful, but, you know, the proof is in the pudding, and we'll see if they're serious about what they said.
You know, Stacey, I was also, I mentioned NFL players, but there are also other incidents. A graduate student at Yale University, I think, fell asleep in the lounge. Cops were called. Five black women were playing golf, and there was an incident there. A former Obama aide moved into an apartment and was seen as a burglar. Sterling Brown, who is with the NBA, parked in a handicapped zone. He shouldn't have done that. But next thing you know, he's on the ground. Is this kind of a window into a world that perhaps a lot of people, and perhaps even a lot of white people, just haven't seen or don't experience?
Yes. So the idea of implicit bias, people think of it as a modern form of racism, but really it's just a way of revealing these associations that we have. And the research suggests that upwards of 70% of whites have some degree of pro-white, anti-black bias. And it's not to say that they don't have explicit desire to be egalitarian, but just in those moments when you aren't really thinking, that there's a little feeling or a little impulse that might lead one in a direction that's less than ideal.
Where does that come from, implicit bias? Is it just part of our DNA, or is there something driving that?
I think there's debate about where it comes from. There are people who think it's a product of socialization. We live in a society where you're exposed constantly to stereotypic images of African Americans from childhood through to adulthood. There are also people who make the argument that it's deeper than that. So monkeys will have implicit bias toward monkeys who aren't in their in-group. Babies, in the first few months of life, prefer people who speak their own language to people who speak a different language because they're familiar with hearing their language while they're in the womb. So
it's kind of in-group, out-group?
Right. So
experience?
This in-group, out-group experience is deep and it's fundamental.
How do you see it, Kevin?
Well, I should say that I think that implicit bias is a very important problem. It's something that's been well established by the social science research. But I'm not 100% convinced that this is necessarily just a matter of implicit bias or unconscious bias. Unfortunately, I can't read the mind of the worker who called the police, but I think that lots of people in our society have biases that they're just no longer willing to admit to holding. And so here, when you couple that with the implicit bias tendencies that are automatic, you also have people who are acting in ways where they're aware of their biases. They know that they make certain assumptions about certain types of people. And I think that often works to the benefit, to the disadvantage of certain types of young black men especially.
Well, taking what you just said, what would you like Starbucks to do this afternoon?
Well, I have my own ideas. I'm not sure that
that's why you're here.
But I would certainly appreciate a very candid discussion where the workers are made to really reflect on their own views and attitudes and to think about why someone in that position might view a couple of young black men who haven't done anything especially wrong as being these dangerous threats that are worthy of having a police intervention. And I think that to get there, you have to really think about the specific stereotypes. You have to think about where do they come from? Are they from negative experiences in the past that are being inappropriately generalized to the whole group? But I think this is going to require a level of candor that would make people uncomfortable.
Mark, what do you hope is accomplished or gets talked about?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm kind of thinking of what I just heard. And, you know, I think the idea that she viewed them as a threat, I don't know that she viewed them as a threat. It's more of just kind of a nuisance. That's just, you know.
And we don't know this.
I think you agree that it's because her voice is not, she's not threatening. I mean, she's not sounding like she's threatened. We have a psychologist here. She can kind of explain that, I'm sure. But she's just kind of like, hello, yeah, you know, a couple of dogs in here. Can you come get them?
Right.
Calling SPCA. You know, got a couple of gentlemen. Can you come get them? One of the persons that we've spoken to said that before she came on board in 2016, there were 11, a total of only 11 911 calls from that store in all of 2016. In 2017, that went up to 42.
Hmm.
And this is a white guy who did the research, and he said what he heard was, he said it, what struck him is, this lady's made this call before. He said she just sounded, it was just like too, you know, she's probably making a drink. Hello, yeah, by the way. And he said, there's no reaction by 911. They don't ask. They don't push back. I've never called 911 and not had a series of questions thrown at me. Just, and so the question is this kind of, you know, are we as citizens paying for private policing? So, I mean, there's that issue. But, you know, what I want to see is beyond today, we're looking for Starbucks to invest in Philadelphia by planting at least 2 community stores. Those are stores that they have around the country. They have 10 now. And they're run by people in the community. Hmm. It's a place for young people to learn to be entrepreneurs. And the money, part of the proceeds go back to that community. Also, a program that would hire reentering citizens, returning citizens. So they do this with veterans. They do this. They had a refugee program. And they do hire returning citizens, but they don't have a program for it.
And these would be returning from prison?
Yes. Yeah. And that, you know, that they would be very intentional. And then finally, the last thing is we've been talking about gentrification a lot in this country. Starbucks definitely has they play a role. When they show up, places that are gentrifying, it accelerates it. And so to work with an independent housing leader board to think about ways that they can mitigate the impact of their showing up. Instead of making the community worse, their showing up should make it better.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Mark Kelly Tyler, with Kevin Woodson and Stacey Sinclair, and with you. We want to know what you hope gets accomplished this afternoon. That's when Starbucks will close all 8,000 stores for training in understanding unconscious bias. Phone number 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with our guests about a whole host of things, including how to understand racial bias, what happened at Starbucks back in April here in Philadelphia, talking about anti-bias training, whether it's effective, and how to best combat racist and prejudiced views. And again, our guests are Kevin Woodson. He's a law professor at Drexel University. Mark Kelly Tyler, pastor of Mother Bethel AME Church here in Philadelphia. And Stacey Sinclair, professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University. Let me play an interview that goes back to April 19th from the Today Show. One of the two men that were arrested at the Starbucks in Philadelphia, Rashawn Nelson, being interviewed.
So, you know, take this opportunity as a stepping stone, you know, to really stand up and, you know, show your greatness. And that you are not judged by the color of your skin, as our ancestors were, or anyone else. You know, this is something that has been going on for years, and everyone's blind to it, but they know what's going on, if you get what I mean. And, you know, just really taking those actions and putting them into place and, you know, help people understand that it's not just a black people thing. This is a people thing. And that's exactly what we want to see out of this, and that's true change. So put action into place and stop using your words.
Put action into place, Stacey, and stop using your words. What do you hope gets accomplished? And this is your field of study, really helping us understand what racial bias is about, what unconscious bias is about. What do you hope gets accomplished this afternoon?
There isn't a lot of evidence that this kind of one-shot intervention is effective. So I hope they have an important, candid conversation. They introduce the idea of, you know, implicit and explicit bias and get people accustomed to the idea that they probably are biased. Everybody is biased against somebody. But what I hope for Starbucks in general is that this is the beginning of a sustained effort to track the behaviors of their employees, to track the satisfaction of their community members, and to figure out ways to continually inspire the employees to work toward living up to their egalitarian values and the values of that Starbucks professes.
Do you worry this could backfire? I mean, that there could be a negative consequence from some kind of training like this?
The research is mixed. So sometimes it has a positive outcome. People will mitigate their behavior. But there are other times, particularly when you make people aware of their biases, but you give them no tools for recognizing when they're being biased or what to do about it, they just get nervous. Right. And that nervousness manifests itself in a way that feels like bias. So if you walk up to order a coffee and a person doesn't look you in the eye and seems really uncomfortable, you're going to experience that as bias. And it might be bias, or it might be that you just train them on their bias and they're so nervous they don't know what to do, and you still feel as if you are being singled out.
Is it about behavior, or is it about what people are thinking?
For me, this is a funny thing for a psychologist to say. I'm more interested in people's behavior than I am on this issue than changing their hearts and minds. So I think if we are able to change people's behaviors over time, mm-hmm. and we can live together in a way that counteracts stereotypes, our hearts and minds will come around.
Well, we'll follow suit.
Right.
You look like you want to say something, Kevin, and I'm sure you do as well, Mark.
Well, I have to agree with everything that the psychology professor said about psychology here. But I think that racial anxiety is in and of itself a big problem here. And I think that's what Professor Sinclair was getting at, with the idea that me being a well-intentioned white person, recognizing that you may perceive me as being biased, that creates problems, creates a negative feedback loop, and it's going to make me uncomfortable. It's going to make me behave in ways that may be just as unpleasant as if I was some hardcore racist. Hmm. And so I think that can contribute to the problem. And if the training doesn't do a good enough job of providing the tools, I think that's where we end up.
And that could have a negative consequence, you're saying?
It could happen. And so in the employment context, there has been research showing that some of this training leads to those types of consequences.
Mark, I was doing some reading about where some of this prejudice and stereotyping comes from, some research showing that young black men are viewed as taller, heavier, and stronger than they actually are, and actually than white men, and that black kids are viewed as older than they are. How should we understand, I guess, the kind of anxiety that we've been talking about, but also that kind of bias? It's so visceral.
Sure. I mean, well, just, you don't have to even look any further than Washington, D.C. You know, I mean, the president's children do something and they're just kids. You know, Don and Eric and Ivanka, they're just kids. They're young. They don't know any better. They're just kids. But, you know, here's Tamir Rice, who's a child playing with a gun, but he's viewed as this. I mean, I don't know what he's viewed as for someone to shoot him and kill him. How do you not see a child with a gun and not automatically assume it's a toy, as opposed to thinking that's actually a real gun? Mm. Mike Brown, the officer who killed him, was quoted as saying that, you know, he looked like the Hulk to me. I mean, you know, we don't, you know, it's for some of us, we hear it and we don't believe it, but I actually believe it. And I mean, and it would account then for why, you know, these things happen. You know, you look at the young ladies who were beaten at a swim party in Texas. We don't talk about it much anymore. A couple of years ago.
I remember that.
Yeah, the same thing. And it's just, so it's, I mean, so on the one hand, yeah, I'm definitely concerned about the behavior, but at a certain point, we have to help, somebody has to help white folk get over the fact that, you know, our children are children just like yours, and they're under 12, they should be treated as under 12. They shouldn't be shot and killed, but they should be treated as a 12-year-old, and I just, it's deeply disturbing.
Well, as the white person sitting in this table here, I can tell you, I can go into, no one follows me in a store. Right. No one crosses the street when they see me coming down the sidewalk. I don't know if that's white privilege or what that is, but I'm sure my experience, I'm looking at you, Stacey, as the other woman here in this room, I'm sure my experience is different from yours. It almost has to be, it seems.
I assume that's the case. I guarantee that's the case. I teach a class on prejudice, and I told the students a story about the local CVS. So our local CVS has a makeup aisle, and you go through the makeup aisle to get to the door where the cash registers are, and they stand right at that cash register and sort of monitor the door. And I think it might be to say hello and goodbye. But invariably, if I don't spend enough time in CVS and I don't leave with a bag, I'm waiting for that person at that cash register to stop me, and under the assumption that I shoplifted something, because I'm walking through this section that has a lot of small things that one could put in their pocket. And the fact that I, a Princeton professor, am braced for that every single time I walk through CVS, like, that's an experience you probably don't have.
Right, right. And I would agree with you at that. And the question is that's your experience. Is that what the person standing at the door, is that their experience of you?
Right. And it may or may not be their experience of me, but I recognize as an African-American woman, as a psychologist who studies these issues, that it could be. That could be what she's thinking. And so there's the bias that that person may or may not have, but also the knowledge that we live in a society with biased people. You have to brace for it all the time. And that perceiving discrimination, even anticipating discrimination, has negative impacts for African Americans.
And Kevin, and to all of you, and to Mark as well, and Stacey, I mean, we are talking about navigating public spaces, right? I mean, this is, the law applies, I guess, differently when it comes to a public space. Or
well,
does it?
It's an interesting question.
Kevin.
So these are, I guess I would refer to these as being kind of quasi-public to some extent. There's also a private dimension of these spaces. These are owned, you know, they're not completely free access. But they have a quasi-public character in that members of the public are expected to enter these spaces, to spend time there, to enjoy themselves and take care of their business and their affairs. And so it's interesting. On the one hand, you can be asked to leave these places, and that's what we see in the Starbucks example. And so there are very different norms there than if you were in a truly public space.
Like a park or something like that.
Right, exactly. And so it gets difficult because what happens here is it's not so much the law that matters, in my opinion, but it's the norms and the practices and the real world experiences. So here, and some of the people who are skeptic about the significance of this incident, they seem not to understand that it's common practice for people to enter these coffee shops and to spend a lot of time there, sometimes without making any purchases, sometimes while just making a trivial purchase at some point an hour into their stay. This happens. We know that this happens. There's been extended commentary on this. We have had a Twitter outpouring of this. And so that's the default by which people need to be thinking about and comparing this incident with others. And I think that if you just focus on the law, if you just look at it narrowly and individually, and you look at whether the Starbucks had the right to ask them to leave, whether the police had the right to arrest them, you're missing the most important part of the story. And I think that that's what's so frustrating for black men in these positions.
And we should say that one of the men wanted to use the bathroom, but because he hadn't bought anything, he was denied that. Starbucks now says that all bathrooms will be open to the general public. And it's interesting, a lot of civil rights movements have been about the use of bathrooms.
Accommodations.
How do you see this, navigating all these public spaces?
I mean, you know,
this
so the church that I pastor, Mother Bethel, was founded over a very similar issue. So our members, our church sits, about eight blocks down the street, going south of here. And we walked out of a church that's about five blocks to the east of here, St. George's. And, you know, in that space where blacks were once welcome to help, you know, they helped fill it up with members, they helped pay for it in the 1780s, and all of a sudden they weren't welcome anymore. It's almost like the service got gentrified, and we're told, you can't sit with whites anymore. Now you must sit in the back, and we're building a balcony. We're going to put you there. And so our founders, Richard Allen and Absalom Jones, who started African Episcopal Church of St. Thomas, were literally yanked up off their knees in the act of praying. It was just that important to the white members that you are not, you're praying among white people. Now, again, these are white people they used to worship with weeks before, that now all of a sudden it's so intense that you're going to yank someone up in the act of prayer, in worship. And that's what led them to just get up and walk out. You know, they kept their dignity and walked out and started their own church. And so when people ask me, well, why do you have a black church and why did you go to an HBCU? And it seems like you all want to be alone. But it's because of the anxiety, you know, that Dr. Sinclair was talking about earlier, this, that when we are in spaces that are white, you just are never certain. So the AME church may have a lot of problems, but racism isn't one. So whatever happens to me there, I know it's at least it's not because I'm black.
Let me just read some comments. An email from Rick. I think the Starbucks training is as much about a marketing stunt to correct the problem as well as awareness training. As it comes corporate down, I question its efficacy as it doesn't deal directly with the people affected as much as insulate the problem within the corporate structure. I mean, obviously, Starbucks is trying to reclaim or claim its name and reputation. Is there anything, Stacey, you think there's anything wrong with that? I mean, it's more a business decision, but
it's a reasonable business decision. My impression, just as a person in society, is that Starbucks really strives to have portray egalitarian values. It's their right to defend it. Mm-hmm. As an academic, as an African American woman, I would like to see them take this opportunity to really do what matters, though. Right. The business decision aside, they can make a difference in the lives of people. There are 8,000 stores, and as we've all said, we've all been in a Starbucks. If you can make Starbucks a more hospitable place for everyone, that is making a true difference.
Is that by, and Kevin, I'll go back to you, is that by understanding implicit bias, or is it who you hire, who gets promoted, who the CEO is? I mean, what happens internally within Starbucks or any organization?
Well, I think just in thinking about organizations in general, accountability is very important. Transparency is very important. These are just kind of fundamental values that whatever your objective is, they're going to help you get there. And so I think that to the extent that we have a problem like this, I would think that what happens from the top down could play a major role. And so even if this is primarily, first and foremost, a PR move or a brand management move, there's still, at the end of the day, we have some very important people who are giving voice to an important perspective. And this is something that's going to have an influence on the rank and file. It's going to shape how people think of their jobs, how they think of their company and their employer. And I think that's valuable in and of itself.
I mean, the CEO, Mark, he apologized. The executive chairman, I was ashamed. I was embarrassed. Do you see this as progress?
Well, listen, I mean, some people are never happy. So we hate what the NFL is doing, obviously. And on this side, there's the cynicism and well-deserved that this is, you know, so I don't know. Honestly, I don't think they could do anything that would not be met with skepticism in this moment. You know, and again, we have a long history that skepticism is well-earned and deserved. But I do think having, you know, met with Mr. Schultz multiple times now, and Roz Brewer and Vivek Varma. What I found striking was that, you know, here's a company that, by all accounts, if this had not happened, we'd be holding up as a model. You know, when they came in, we've met with companies before in other places.
We meaning Power.
Yeah, Power and other organizing I've done. And when these kind of things happen, it's kind of like, let's go find everybody black that works for us and bring them in. It's like, who are you? Well, I'm the custodian. I mean, it's like, who are these people?
You mean that?
I'm not kidding. Where it's just like, seriously, you did not just bring in like the black person from housekeeping and we're here talking to this major hotel about, you know, contracts. But, you know, everyone across the table, for the most part, were people of color and a lot of women. So Roz Brewer, African-American woman, Spelman grad, you know, is the COO. You know, Vivek Varma, a person from India, runs. He's kind of like they're like Schultz's right and left hand, and a number of other people who are in incredibly important positions in that company. And so this is, I think, an opportunity for them as well to bring their world experience in. And so, I know this is a one day thing, but I expect that there are going to be a number of things that will follow up that will not only be important to Starbucks, but will be an important corporate example for the rest of America. And I think that's what we've been pushing on Schultz, is that you've got an opportunity to help lead other corporations and this country, by the way in which, obviously, look at the NFL, that's not the way to do it.
Let me read an email from Sherry. What woke me up about bias is hearing the stories of other people who are treated very different than white folk. For example, a black executive who was at an offsite retreat center having breakfast was asked by a white person to get them coffee as she was on her way to the bathroom. I get that we have bias, but with consciousness, we can make different decisions. Stacey, do you agree with that? I mean, being aware of your bias, is that at least a first step in understanding how that might affect another person?
I definitely think so. That's the first step in the right direction. So what happens, you need to be aware of your bias. You need to, it's interesting the person said with consciousness. So you also need to have the mental energy and space to stop and think more deeply. And you need the motivation to do that as well. But
you have to want to do it.
You do have to want to do it, because otherwise, why would you waste the mental energy if this wasn't something that was important to you?
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Stacey Sinclair, professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University, where she studies prejudice and bias. Mark Kelly Tyler, pastor of Mother Bethel AME Church here in Philadelphia, co-chair of the Clergy Caucus of Power, and Power stands for Philadelphians Organized to Witness, Empower, and Rebuild, and Kevin Woodson, associate professor of law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law, talking about what happened in Philadelphia a month ago at Starbucks in Center City and what the company is doing. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking about what happened here in Philadelphia back in April. Two black men, Rashawn Nelson, Dante Robinson, were arrested at a Starbucks. They were there to meet a friend. This was all caught on a video that was tweeted out by a customer there, and became a national and global crisis and controversy. And this afternoon, Starbucks is closing all 8,000 of its stores for training and understanding unconscious bias. Let me play a clip from an instructional video, part of this anti-bias training that will be taking place today. And this is Starbucks board member Melody Hobson talking with Rachel Godsell, director of policy at the Perception Institute.
So today, when we close down our stores to get more training and hopefully come away with more learnings around bias, can we structurally change the organization?
So I think we would say the structural work is something that has to be done for far longer than the 4-hour day.
And that's policy?
That's the work the company has to do to support the partners in the individual work, because one of the things we don't want to see is for each person to have to bear this burden alone.
You nodded your head, Stacey, when she said, I mean, this is not on one person's shoulders.
Right. I mean, I think that's precisely the way to go. What I've been talking about, the importance of behaviors, and the right structures will support the right behaviors. So I've been sitting here thinking actually about what Mark said about the particular woman at that Starbucks who seemed to be calling the police a lot more than her predecessor. And if there were just mechanisms in place that tracked this kind of behavior, and to the extent it was unusual, was flagged in some way, you know, someone might have been able to come in and sort of make it clear to her that this is not necessarily appropriate before it, you know, blew up on TV and Twitter, et cetera.
Oh, and I mean, assuming that was correct and she was calling more than her predecessor, what does a company do about that?
Right. But, it, you know, if you have clear structures and clear tracking in place, you can catch these kinds of unusual behaviors and mitigate them before there's an incident.
Kevin, you want to say something?
Well, I think that goes back to what I was trying to get at when I mentioned the importance of accountability and transparency. So it's really that simple. If the higher-ups have access to that information, they can at least attempt to correct the situation before it spirals out of control.
I was thinking about, you know, if people want to do this. I mean, we're talking about 8,000 stores that are going to close. So I don't know how many employees that is, but obviously tens of thousands of employees. Mark, if someone is there and they just feel like, oh, gosh, you know, I'm going to get dragged to some kind of a training I do not want, I don't care. How do we deal with that? Or is someone just left to believe what they believe?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, Starbucks can only hire people from the culture. And so it's, I mean, really, and the stores are everywhere, right? So the stores are not just in big metropolitan areas where the white people who work there have had a lot of contact and interaction with people of color. But they're coming from everywhere, rural parts of the country and everything else. So I expect there'll be resistance. But, you know, the hope is, again, that this will not be short-lived, but it will be long-term. And I think Kevin said something earlier as well, that it's about what happens at the top.
Yeah.
You know, and if the top is serious about this to the point where there are real penalties, you know, for not, you know, taking this on, you don't have to believe it, but you've got to do it. I mean, the same thing would happen when we integrated the military, sports teams, and everywhere else, and schools. And so this is just a part of, you know, going into the workplace.
Stacey, I was thinking about most people don't work at Starbucks as a barista for a lifelong occupation. It's a job you have, and then probably moving on to a different kind of job. So this really has to be ongoing, it seems. You can't just close whatever today's date is in the afternoon and think that you're going to take care of it when you've got this workforce that's constantly turning over.
Exactly, and that's another reason for the importance of accountability, for the importance of structure. Because once you have policies in place that dictate appropriate behavior or figure out ways to recommend appropriate behavior, then anyone who's dropped into the system can follow along. There's interesting research showing that with respect to interracial anxiety, people, whites who are high in interracial anxiety, when they interact with an African-American person, that African-American person can pick up on it and see that they're uncomfortable. But if you give them a script, the effect goes away.
Meaning how?
If you just give them some talking points.
Oh. Then like this is how you talk to a black person?
This is how you talk to a person.
To a person.
Right. Talk about these things. And that allows them to sort of let go of the anxiety and just follow the checklist. And, you know, I would love for our hearts and minds to be changed. But in the meantime, I'm happy with the checklist.
Well, is it because we don't know each other? I mean, there just isn't enough interaction between among races so that the experience that you might have as someone who's outside your race feels strange and perhaps even anxiety producing.
Oh, absolutely. And I really think this is an underestimated dimension of racial inequality in America. The fact that we have this ongoing segregation, not just segregation in the explicit sense, but segregation in terms of our family life, our social life, of course, our neighborhoods that remain segregated. All of this really shapes our level of comfort in interacting with people from other races, and it also shapes the assumptions. And on a more cognitive level, it also shapes what we actually remember about people, which experiences we remember. So if I don't have many positive, enduring relationships with people of a certain racial group, but there are negative stereotypes about them, and I can think of one or two negative incidents that occurred, that's going to really compound into something that's even more invidious. And I really think that as long as we remain segregated as a society, we're going to have discrimination in the workplace. We're going to have discrimination in these types of settings where you have strangers interacting with each other. And I just think it's incredibly unfortunate.
Well, Mark, you talked about black churches and black colleges and universities as a place where a black person can feel safer than perhaps in that more integrated world. Some have said Sunday morning is the most segregated time in this country because of the way churches are.
Yeah, well, that's true. And again, I gave my business card to somebody I was buying a car. It was like years ago, and it said African Methodist Church. It was some church I was pastoring in Missouri. And the guys in Kansas City, he's like, oh, so I can't come in? And I said, sure you can. He said, well, then why is it African? I said, well, ask your ancestors. Like, I'm not trying to be funny, but it's not like it was African Methodist by choice. It's kind of by, you know, it's not like we, you know, we set out to want to be in a segregated church. We were part of the white Methodist church and basically were felt unwanted. And even to this day, you know, there are black members in the white Methodist church who still have the need for a black caucus and black this and black that, because even today in the 21st century, they still have that same discomfort that our ancestors had in 1787.
Yeah, you want to say something, Stacey? We've got some callers, and I've got some more comments as well, but no, go ahead.
Sure. I just wanted to say, thinking about what Kevin's saying and what Mark's saying, it's about balance. So there is a lot of research suggesting that intergroup contact reduces bias, particularly these more affective, anxiety, feeling-related kind of biases. And that calls for people interacting beyond their group boundaries. But at the same time, we know that when people interact beyond their group boundaries, there's anxiety, there's discrimination. And so we have to balance the desire to help everyone learn how to be together with the fact that it's math, right? There are only so many African Americans to go around to reduce all the white people's biases, and it's exhausting. And so,
does it feel exhausting?
Sometimes.
Because of the kind of consciousness that you have to have, or vigilance that you have to have.
I'm okay now. But I do remember once at a conference, it was after when I was at University of Virginia, there were a number of racial incidents, and I was on the stage and I said, just work it out, right? I'm tired. I can't be everyone's diversity experience. And apparently, I just said that on the radio, but it psychologists who were in graduate school at the time, today, now they're professors, and they remember that moment.
Really? Just said, I'm tired.
Yeah.
I'm tired.
Yeah. And they said, I'm tired. And then just that really resonated for people in a way that I can't live down even if I wanted to now.
Well, I think it's an important thing. You're smiling, Kevin. Then we'll get some callers in.
Well, I just have a different experience because I was sort of born into that role. And I grew up as the quote unquote smart black guy in a predominantly white school. And so I'm just used to that.
Let me read some more comments. One from Gail. One glaring truth is that the only reason this incident became a lightning rod is because it was caught on video, highlighting the reality that often black people aren't believed when they tell their truth and share their experiences and stories. An email from Tom. Is this a Starbucks issue or an issue with the overreaction of the police? When I first heard the story, my initial reaction was no loitering? From the reports I heard, the Starbucks employee asked the customers to leave when they were not making a purchase. The overreaction of the police to arrest and question the individuals appears to me the root of the problem. We could do a whole segment on that, but let me get first Janet from Philadelphia to join us. Janet, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a few instances. I'm 68 years old, Philadelphian, and it amazes me that we are still dealing with the situation. When I was 30, I took a summer to work at an insurance company, a summer from teaching. And the young white women that worked there, they were younger than me, had never been to South Street, Center City. It was a big deal then. They were afraid to go. Their parents told them not to go. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, one of the young white women was pregnant and not married. And her parents had taken vacation to deal with it. I mean, we're not that different. When are we going to start realizing that we are a human species and this racism that has been labeled in this country is just absurd?
Well, Janet, I appreciate your call. I'm not sure who to toss it to, but I'm going to give it to you, Mark.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting. One of the things, when we met with the police department not long ago in that meeting, one of the things that was interesting is they said that there are white officers in the Northeast who've never been past Cotman. Before Cotman Avenue. You know, the geography that is, they grew up in the Northeast, have never come down. They don't, and I mean, you go up there, it's a different world. And so, and I guess, you know, for black folk in America, I know this is a gross overgeneralization, but by and large, we have had to be bilingual, and we have had to know the white experience for our own preservation, just to live and to survive. You've got to know white people. You have to know their ways, know what's important to them and all these things. White people have had a luxury where they have not had to know anyone else. That's white privilege. That's a part of it. That's why, you know, you have the guy in Starbucks in the Fresh Market 2 weeks ago, you know, telling people who are speaking Spanish that you must not be from here. I'm going to get you deported. As though somehow speaking Spanish, it proves your documentation, you know, proves that you're an American or not. There's no law. But this is what goes along with, you know, being white in America. And so it's going to have to be some real willingness on white people in America to want to know and engage everyone else the way in which everyone else has had to know their experience.
Well, and that's why I think these videos are instructive, if I can put it that way, Stacey, in that if you're not there, you're not a black person, but you see what happened at the Starbucks, you see something that you might not have thought could happen.
Right.
Something as everyday as that.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I was thinking about your caller and the fact that she referenced someone who was pregnant. And there is, just to illustrate what the meaning of these kinds of day-to-day interactions, there's some new research showing that just living in an area surrounded by people who are biased, controlling for all the other things that you would think matter, poverty, unemployment, the demographics of the area, relates to African-American women's birth weight of their children. So, because of stress. So over and above daily stress, the stress of being exposed to discrimination, the stress of perceiving discrimination affects the birth weight of your children. It affects your risk of cardiovascular disease. It affects the likelihood that you'll get hypertension. I mean, it is something that literally gets under people's skin. And it was, for one brief moment, I think, it was articulated in a way that everybody could see what that experience looks like.
Janet, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. A tweet from Megan. My hope for this afternoon's Starbucks training is that a mega corporation can have a massive impact in terms of awareness, education, and justice around discrimination in a way that we seem to be struggling to have otherwise. We don't have time to really get into this, but certainly when we had our first black president, everyone thought, oh, you know, now we're going to have this conversation about race and we're going to have the conversation that we need to have. And perhaps it is, Kevin, just it's a matter of lots of mini conversations, ongoing conversations, as opposed to this great, you know, moment of racial realization.
I think so. And I have to say, I'm probably more pessimistic than most people on that front. I find that, and this goes to my own personal experience as well, people are incredibly adept at making exceptions for black people that they like or that they know and think highly of, and then still treating all the others as either nuisances or threats. And I think that that's something that it adds a level of complexity and difficulty to this problem. And I think the same, to get to a point you were raising about the power of the video.
Yeah.
I'm skeptical about that as well, because if being on social media for the past 10 years and reading YouTube comments has taught me one thing, it's that people are remarkably imaginative and creative when it comes to conjuring up excuses for inexcusable behavior. And I think that they can fill in the gaps, they can create gaps where gaps don't even exist. And I think that people who don't want to, who want to resist race, acknowledging and addressing racism can have it within their powers to do so.
I wish we could go on. We have to end our discussion. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Kevin Woodson, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Also, Stacey Sinclair. Stacey, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It was a great conversation.
Thank you so much. And Mark Kelly, Tyler, thank you for coming in as well.
Absolutely.
And go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and we did post, or we will be posting some photos from this morning's interview. My thanks to Mary Cummings Jordan for filling in for me so I could go to Scotland on vacation. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.